This is The Reason Interview, and I'm your host, Nick Gillespie. Few stories are generating as much heat and interest as the ongoing protests in Hong Kong, where mostly young demonstrators are taking to the streets by the millions to call for democracy, autonomy, and privacy from authoritarian rule in Beijing. In just the past week, the general manager of the Houston Rockets basketball team caused an international incident when he tweeted support for the protesters. This was a big deal because the NBA is huge in China. In fact, there are more NBA fans in China than there are people in the United States. Think about that. The Rockets team owner and the NBA leadership quickly apologized, but not before the network carrying basketball in China announced that it would not show any Rockets games this season. Now, the creators of South Park took a slightly different tack. When an episode of their show mocking government censorship was shut down by Beijing, Matt Stone and Trey Parker issued a caustic fake apology that read in part, "Like the NBA, we welcome the Chinese censors into our homes and into our hearts. We too love money more than freedom and democracy." A month ago, Reason TV producer Zach Weismuller traveled to Hong Kong to document exactly what's happening in the streets of a place long known for nearly unbridled capitalism. In today's Reason interview, Zach tells me how the protesters are using both high-tech and low-tech means to get their message out, why they're inspired by the old Bruce Lee saying, "Be like water," and whether they're likely to actually achieve their goals of securing democratic representative rule and privacy from a government that is perfecting the surveillance state in the 21st century. Zach, thanks for talking.
A pleasure to be here. Thanks, Nick.
So about a month ago, or a little bit more than that, you went to Hong Kong. Set the scene. What are the Hong Kong people protesting, and what did you find when you showed up?
Well, this began as a protest against a very specific action, a proposed extradition bill, which it's a kind of strange story, but a Hong Kong resident was visiting Taiwan with his girlfriend, and this was part of some sort of murder plot. Apparently, he murdered his girlfriend in a hotel room and then fled back to Hong Kong, and Taiwan was having trouble extraditing him. And so This caused the Legislative Council and the chief executive to propose a bill that would make it much easier both to extradite to Taiwan and also to mainland China. And that sparked these protests because it was widely viewed as a pretext to be able to extradite any sort of political dissidents to the mainland. And the background here is that there had already been massive protests in 2014 under what was became known as the Umbrella Movement, because the protesters used umbrellas to shield themselves from tear gas canisters. And there had been booksellers who had been selling books that the Communist Party did not approve of and had kind of disappeared under mysterious circumstances and then reemerged in the mainland and kind of forced to apologize. And now they are kind of in exile in Taiwan. So there's a lot of kind of understandable anxiety about what that extradition bill would allow to happen.
Right. And can you talk a little bit, you know, there is obviously Hong Kong for decades had been a British protectorate. Around the turn of the century, control of it was turned back over to mainland China. Although Hong Kong is technically autonomous, it, you know, it has this, you know, massive giant breathing down its neck. How is, you know, it, that's the essential pretext for everything, right?
Yes. So it exists under what's known as the one country, two systems model after Britain handed it over in 1997. And that was a 50-year agreement that the conditions were that Britain would exit, but China would respect what is known there as the Basic Law, which is kind of like their constitution, which enshrines certain civil liberties, the right to assemble, freedom of speech to some degree, and some limited level of democracy. And so that is actually the crux of the matter, because it began as a protest against this specific extradition bill, but then expanded into a wider list of demands. There's actually five specific demands that the movement has come up with. And the most important one really is the call for greater democracy, the ability to actually elect their chief executive, who is kind of appointed through this arcane electoral college that is more or less controlled by Beijing's government. And then they also want to be able to elect all of their legislative representatives. And a little more than half of them are currently selected by these functional constituencies, which are essentially interest groups for the various industries in Hong Kong.
How many protesters are there and who are they? You know, are they young people? Are they old people? Are they a mix? Are they, you know, characterize the protesters that you saw and met.
It's a mixture, but certainly skews young. This is a youth-led movement. And again, this all emerged from those 2014 protests, the Umbrella Movement, which there were some kind of youth stars that arose out of that, one of them being Joshua Wong, who was 15 years old at the time and has become one of the recognizable faces of this movement. He heads a political organization called Demasisto. And actually, he and five other youth activists out of that movement were elected following those protests in 2016 and then booted out of the legislature for advocating what is called self-determination, kind of an amorphous term, but basically means they want to be able to vote on things and have more democracy and have more control over what happens in the local politics of Hong Kong rather than being dictated from Beijing. So that's the makeup of that movement. And then the size, there's been, you know, estimating crowd size is difficult, but the estimates have ranged from the hundreds of thousands to even over a million for some of these marches. And this is on in a city that has a population of 7 million people. So that's a pretty significant proportion of the population coming.
Got it. And I remember, you know, going back to the idea of the youth movement aspect of this and the earlier demonstrations a few years ago, they were even copying signals from the Hunger Games, you know, which was a huge franchise. And it was this insane, bizarre moment that was deeply moving, actually, that, you know, they were making the Mockingjay symbol and things like that. Yeah. Where do they stand right now? I mean, are they, you know, when you were there, were their spirits high? Are they expecting, you know, a kind of replay of Tiananmen Square where at some point the civility disappears and the tanks roll in? What was the mood and temperature that you experienced while you were there?
Yeah, so I was there in early September, which I was almost like I was a little bit in the eye of the hurricane. So there was this calm before the storm and people were still on edge, but what was rapidly approaching was October 1st, which is was the 70th anniversary of the establishment of the People's Republic, i.e. the communist takeover.
Communist
of
China.
China, yeah. And so that was expected to be a big, there's going to be a crackdown and there's going to be an escalation. And that did play out. And so things have really escalated since I left. But what really seems to happen is kind of during the week, things calm down a little bit. And then during the weekend, everyone's off work and is able to go out in the streets and things amp up again. But now from what I've been reading and monitoring, it's a more kind of consistent turnout every night. And there's escalating violence. A couple young teens have been shot in these clashes with police officers that had not happened yet. There'd been no gunfire when I was there. And just today, Carrie Lam has been not saying that the Chinese military is going to get involved, but floating out there the idea that it's always an option. And there's kind of this towering building that is the People's Army barracks right near the port in Hong Kong that is kind of just looming over there. And that's been a focal point. So there's definitely a lot of anxiety about that. You know, the memory of Tiananmen is obviously strong there. And I would say in general, there's a sense that this is kind of the last stand. It's now or never.
Carrie Lam is the Chinese or mainland China installed kind of ruler of Hong Kong.
She's the,
right?
Yeah, she's the chief executive of Hong Kong, and she is perceived by the protest movement of being a puppet of the Beijing government, and not without reason, I would say, because the way she's selected, they've totally rigged the game, and they have kind of, with the way that they're able to stack the deck in their favor is they have money in all of these various industries that are able to choose people in the legislature and also in the electoral college. And so they're able to basically buy loyalty. And so you see this very strange divide in the legislature where these kind of appointed people all lean towards the Beijing central government. And then the vast majority of the ones that are directly elected are pro-democracy and on the side of the demonstrators.
What does Beijing want out of this? Because, you know, before when Britain was ruling or, you know, kind of securing Hong Kong's autonomy, it was famous as a place that had virtually no business regulation. It did have a somewhat robust welfare state. Healthcare and housing was essentially guaranteed, but then everything else was left up for grabs. What has changed since the Chinese, mainland China, has taken over? And what is communist China looking for out of Hong Kong?
Well, what's really changed is the ascent of Xi Jinping to the presidency in mainland China. There was a time after the handover where mainland China really did abide by this kind of hands-off approach to Hong Kong, and that worked out very well for them. As you mentioned, this was the economic engine for them, and we saw, you know, earlier after, you know, Mao's death, there was the economic miracle once when the mainland, you know, liberalized its markets. So, you know, they do understand, you know, the power of markets, and to some degree have replicated that right across from Hong Kong in these kind of factory towns like Shenzhen, where the big Foxconn complex is. And that also actually has weirdly changed the balance, because these manufacturing cities like Shenzhen have even begun to generate so much economic power for the mainland that they're a little less reliant on Hong Kong. And so the combination of that plus Xi Jinping's kind of seeming desire to consolidate as much power as quickly as possible is leading them to, I think, try to take Hong Kong back into the fold even before that 50-year agreement ends in 2047.
In one of the videos that you posted, they're up at Reason TV's YouTube channel as well as at Reason.com on our video tab. You know, the protesters that you talked to said that they want American support. What does that mean?
So what they are asking for specifically is for Congress to pass this Hong Kong Human Rights and Democracy Act, which would do a variety of things. The main elements of it are that right now Hong Kong has kind of privileged trading partner status with the U.S., which means just kind of they don't have to deal with as many, you know, customs and tariffs and so forth. And they want to make that contingent on China upholding the one country, two systems agreement. And their belief there is that if the U.S. can kind of use that leverage, it'll make China think twice, because if we, you know, make it more difficult for Hong Kong to trade and for its and kind of hamper its economy, that will hurt Hong Kong. And then there's also an element of kind of targeted sanctions that would go after individuals, Chinese individuals, who violate the rights of Hong Kong citizens. And then the third element is, you know, a lot of these young people want to come to the U.S. to study. They're afraid that, you know, having an arrest on their record is going to prevent them from getting a visa. Mm-hmm. So they want immigration to, you know, have a policy where they don't hold arrests related to the protest movement against visa applicants.
Do you have a sense of how the Trump administration and or the U.S. government, you know, major powers in Congress, how are they orienting towards this type of request?
There's some momentum towards that. There is bipartisan support of Hong Kong. Nancy Pelosi is a big supporter, Marco Rubio. So the bill itself is still in committee. Several of the leaders of the protest, well, I shouldn't say leaders because it is a decentralized leaderless movement, but several of the higher profile faces actually went to Hong Kong in mid-September, or went to D.C. in mid-September and, you know, made their case. So I would say the chances are, fairly good of it advancing through Congress. Trump, on the other hand, you know, he's in the middle of these trade talks with China and has been kind of all over the place with Hong Kong. He seems to be using them as leverage in these trade talks. So I really cannot predict what he is going to do. But I will say that some of the people I talked to in Hong Kong are actually glad that Trump is kind of tightening the screws via trade because they think that you know, strengthens their position.
So anything that's standing up to the Chinese regime is seen as a, as a good thing.
Yeah. And that's why people here, I think, have at times been kind of puzzled to see various, imagery from the U.S., American flags, even a couple pro-Trump signs. And I think that it's a kind of, an enemy of my enemy type situation.
Right. In the most recent video that you did from Hong Kong, or that was finally produced, it came out about a week ago or less than a week ago at Reason.com, at Reason TV's YouTube channel. You talk about how Hong Kong protesters are specifically combating the surveillance state. And in this sense, the Hong Kong story is obviously important in its own right, because you have this underdog group that is pushing for autonomy and individual rights and self-determination against, in many ways, the last great authoritarian state on the planet, unapologetic, growth-oriented authoritarian state. It's a fascinating story on its own, but then it's also a kind of instance of what is likely to come next, because, the Chinese government has been really forward in pushing kind of surveillance state apparatus, and the protesters are pushing out against it. Can you talk a little bit about how the protesters are kind of routing around or screwing with the surveillance state? What are some of the technologies and techniques they're using to organize themselves and get their messages out?
Sure. So in the mainland China, they famously have started implementing facial recognition technology on a grand scale. Mm-hmm. There's the social credit system, which kind of rates you on your good behavior and can have consequences such as limiting your travel, ability to get in good schools.
And everything is kind of facilitated through WeChat or a series of kind of, apps, all-purpose apps that allow you to book travel and to communicate, do, all sorts of activity that, are one of the primary engines by which these social credit scores are facilitated.
Yes. And a lot of people have heard of the Great Firewall, which severely restricts what kind of material can make it through the internet in China. Mm-hmm. It's a tightly controlled internet there.
Okay. So that's happening in the mainland. And then how are the Hong Kong protesters, dealing with all that?
Yeah. So they luckily do not have to deal with that widespread level of control and surveillance yet, but they see it coming soon. And there have been these, what they call smart lampposts erected in Hong Kong that is a lamppost / security camera. And they have taken electric chainsaws to them and torn some of them down and kind of taken the components out and analyzed them and found, Ethernet switches in there that lead them to believe that perhaps some of the data being captured could be transmitted back to the mainland. They've found components that were manufactured by suppliers of the Chinese surveillance system. And so they're very wary of that sort of technology kind of subtly creeping in. And then you mentioned the apps that are controlled by the Chinese government on the mainland. They don't use any of those. They're committed to encryption tools. So Telegram is really one of the most popular means of communication there. It's a encrypted app that the key for there's a number of encrypted apps out there. There's, you know, WhatsApp, and they use that as well. But mm-hmm. Telegram is really kind of seemed to become the go-to because they can create these unlimited size groups that are sometimes thousands of people, and you can sign up anonymously. You don't even have to give your phone number. And so there are these groups that they use to coordinate anonymously. And that's one technique they use. They also are able to, when they're in person, they can use the AirDrop function on their phones, which is, you know, Bluetooth technology. So they don't even have to be connected to the internet, and they will share, you know, images, kind of maps to show where the march is going, instructions. And this all feeds into the overall ethos of the movement, which is decentralized and exemplified by the motto, the Bruce Lee motto they've embraced, be water. So the 2014 protests were all about occupying. It was inspired by the Occupy Wall Street type movement. You go and you camp out in a park. Now it's all about, you know, showing up unannounced, being fluid, and then, you know, dissipating. And that has proved very durable for them. We're going on 4 months now. The government doesn't really know what to do with that because they can't just shut down the park where the protesters are occupying, because they'll just coordinate and find something else. Oh, and one other thing I should mention is that they're also very conscious of the way that they pay for things, because they realize that our credit cards are a tracking device. When you buy a ticket using your credit card at the train station, they know that you're riding the train to a certain location. And so they've embraced cash. And there's also a contactless payment system called Octopus that is something that the government implemented that they've kind of eschewed. And they've realized that they need to scrub their digital footprints if they're going to kind of stay one step ahead of the state.
That's fascinating. So there's these high-tech workarounds such as Telegram and whatnot, but then there's the low-tech ones like you're talking about, where they're cutting down streetlights that have, you know, super sophisticated surveillance equipment on it. Talk a bit about the masks that they use, because this, you know, this is another, it's kind of a low-tech way of foiling certain types of facial recognition and old-style, you know, kind of recognition techniques by the police.
Yeah, I would say most of them are wearing masks. And certainly if you ever try to interview them on camera, they're going to slip on the mask. Okay. And that has been that's proven to be extremely effective, to the extent that last week the chief executive Carrie Lam issued an order banning face masks. She invoked an emergency law, emergency powers to do this, like, unilaterally, and that has not turned out well for her. People have kind of just blatantly disobeyed, continued wearing the masks. And now you see these videos of Hong Kong police just running up and tackling people wearing masks. But at some point, if there are enough people disobeying, you can't tackle everyone. And that, you know, the face mask ban really was another, I'd say, inflection point that escalated the levels of violence that we've seen coming out of Hong Kong.
It's fascinating because in the United States, a number of cities for sure, and possibly states, I'm not sure, you know, in the wake of various eras of in the Reconstruction South and elsewhere, would pass bans from wearing masks or coverings that obscured your face in public because they were trying to minimize the power of groups like the Ku Klux Klan. So it's just kind of a fascinating thing to see how, you know, depending on the context, you know, the recourse to a mask can be something about individual liberation or, you know, kind of a creepy attempt to mask your identity from responsibility.
Yeah, we've seen the masks issue manifest here fairly recently with the rise of Antifa. They often will wear masks, mm-hmm. and I've seen kind of heated debates come about whether, you know, cities should ban face masks or not. And I got to say, my experience in Hong Kong puts me firmly in the let's not ban face masks camp.
What was it like to be there? You don't speak Mandarin, right? Or you don't speak Chinese, but you were there with translators. But what was it like to be in the midst of these mass protests? You know, how did that make you feel? You know, what's your impression of all that?
Yeah, and the language there is, you know, they do speak Mandarin and also Cantonese, which they kind of mm-hmm. view as their like local language. And there's a whole kind of back and forth there between the mainland that's trying to standardize everything mm-hmm. in Mandarin. But yes, I worked with a local cameraman, who very talented guy, Edwin Lee. So when you watch the videos and see this remarkable footage, that's him, and he's just a really impressive guy. And then I had a translator when I was out talking to the protesters, and it was, you know, exciting, a little bit harrowing at times. I never got involved in anything super dangerous. There was always kind of like the possibility of that. Like, we traveled with gas masks and helmets just in case. I, you know, thankfully avoided all that. But one of the protests that I joined was a march to the soccer stadium, where the plan was to mm-hmm. boo the Chinese national anthem. It was a World Cup qualifier with Hong Kong and Iran. And there's been proposals floated to actually ban the booing of the Chinese national anthem. And so they showed up, and, you know, seeing that kind of mass disobedience, and it's a mixture between, like, you know, a slightly dangerous situation and a kind of like carnivalesque atmosphere where everyone's, you know, at this soccer game having fun, but at the same time chanting political slogans that never, you know, seen or been a part of something like that before. It was remarkable and something I will never forget having experienced.
One of the most recent videos that you did, which is not about Hong Kong, but is related to it, is titled "The Decentralized Web is Coming. Amazon, Google, Facebook, and Twitter are in the federal government's crosshairs, but the technology necessary to undermine their dominance may already exist." Can you discuss that a little bit? Explain what you're going for there and how it actually, even though it's, you know, it's about these, you know, massive U.S.-based companies, is actually related and adjacent to what you were covering in Hong Kong.
Yeah, the way I see that it's related is that with the kind of consolidation of tech over the last decade in Facebook and Amazon and Twitter, we are seeing that the more centralized these companies become, kind of the easier it is for them to succumb to various pressures, including governmental pressure and including pressure from authoritarian regimes. And China, I would say at this point, doesn't have a whole lot of sway over what, you know, for instance, Facebook does. But Facebook does abide by, you know, EU standards. And this is a regard where America still is exceptional in our protection of speech. No other country has the kind of speech protections that we have. But when you have a global company like Facebook, they kind of are just going to go with the lowest standard. They're gonna bring in more restrictive speech codes if that gets them access in more places. And so that's where I see the role of decentralization coming in, is if these companies do become more and more restrictive, then there will be more and more incentive to move other places. And in order to achieve that, the kind of entire way that the internet works would need to be rethought a little bit. And the point of the piece is that there are people that are already rethinking it. People who were involved in designing the version of the web that we use now, people like Tim Berners-Lee. And what they're thinking is that instead of using Hypertext Transfer Protocol, which is that HTTP that you type into your web browser, they want to use something like IPFS, the Interplanetary File System, which instead of pointing you to a specific server somewhere that's owned by someone like Google or Amazon, it would point you to a specific piece of content that has an ID linked to it. And that piece of content could be held anywhere. You could have, you know, imagine a world where all of our internet routers are also mini servers. And that is really the way out of this current situation. You know, that you hear on Capitol Hill about a desire to break up big tech. There's a variety of reasons why that's problematic. I'm not optimistic that doing that would even solve the problem in and of itself. But a technological solution, in the same way that encryption by its very nature cannot be controlled by the government, we need a technological solution that by its very nature forces the decentralization regardless of what elected politicians in DC want to do.
And also major corporations, right, that want everything, you know, if Amazon, Google, Facebook, Twitter, and other companies want everything to kind of go through their protocols, right? And so if you're able to communicate directly with people without them as an intermediary, that is also decentralizing and potentially liberating.
Yes. And if we want to just have a hedge against the rise of authoritarianism in the US, you know, we're not anywhere close to what's going on in China, but it's good to have a hedge, I think. And there's a convenience to being able to call Mark Zuckerberg in front of Congress, lean on him and say, this is how we want you to run your company and control the information flowing over your network in the interest of national security. If we can avoid that even being an option, I'd say that's more the better.
Yeah. Now, to go back to Hong Kong, you know, the most recent kind of developments in kind of the Hong Kong-China story has to do with the NBA and the general manager of the Houston Rockets, a good NBA team that has a massive following in China, which itself, there are more NBA fans in China than there are residents of the United States. And the Rockets, years ago, they drafted and had Yao Ming, a Chinese native, as their center for many years, a Hall of Fame player. And now when the Houston Rockets general manager tweeted out support for the Hong Kong protesters, the response was pretty swift and pretty fierce. On the NBA, on the American side, the NBA distanced themselves. The general manager took his tweet, he deleted his tweet. The team owner said, this guy doesn't represent, you know, what the Houston Rockets want. The NBA apologized to, you know, hurting the feelings of fans in China, and they made separate Chinese and American tweets directed at audiences. In China, the streaming service that carries NBA basketball is hugely popular there, said they're not carrying Rockets games. What is your sense of this? How do you think that plays out? And what is the role, you know, what should we expect of an American organization like the NBA or a subunit of that, like the Houston Rockets? How do you think they should behave in this type of circumstance?
Yeah, you can see exactly why it played out this way for all the reasons you just outlined, all the economic incentives. And it's not just the NBA, it's Hollywood is constantly, the big studio movies are, you know, kind of edited or written in a way that is not going to offend a Chinese audience.
And a couple of years ago, I think it was the first time a Matt Damon movie called The Wall, about the wall of Great Wall of China, was actually kind of created from the ground up with cooperation from the Chinese government and Chinese business interests. And yeah, this is one of the things people have talked about for years now, that as the Chinese market gets bigger, Hollywood is very quick to kowtow to, you know, what they expect Chinese demands.
I'm ambivalent about it, really, like, because I think that it's good that people in mainland China have a chance to watch the NBA or watch Hollywood films. I think, like, exposure to other cultural phenomena is a good thing, and that's partially how you change, you know, hearts and minds. But I also think that at some point, you, as a consumer, you have to say, how far are we going to go to appease this extremely anti-liberal regime. I mean, I was reading earlier this week about their response to Adam Silver, the NBA commissioner, just came out and sort of backtracked, but not really. He just kind of gave a mealy mouth, like, we're sorry to both sides type of thing. And then China's response is, no, we're still pulling the Rockets game. And we also are very dissatisfied with his support of freedom of expression. And anything that challenges national sovereignty is not protected by freedom of speech. I mean, that's so anathema to what we're all about that I think that obviously, the only way to counter China's market influence is for American customers at some point to say, like, we're not okay with this. And I don't know what that tipping point is. I mean, there was a big backlash to what the NBA did, but I think it's something that we're going to have to think about more and more, especially, you know, as libertarians who believe, you know, in the ability of the market to, you know, correct sort of bad ideas.
Yeah. Well, and it's, you know, part of it is unfair, perhaps, to expect the NBA to do something dramatic. I don't know if people are to say, like, well, just, you know, refuse to share the games with China or something like that, or break the contract for NBA broadcasts in China. Whereas we don't necessarily say that about other business interests that do business with China. It gets complicated. And then I know a lot of conservatives are dissatisfied with the NBA, unlike the NFL, was much more kind of accepting and embracing of players exhibiting or, you know, demonstrating solidarity with Black Lives Matter and other kinds of political statements. The NBA itself refused to host an All-Star game in Charlotte, North Carolina, when there were certain bathroom laws in place and whatnot. So it gets complicated very quickly.
Yeah. And I agree more or less with that critique that, what I agree with is that it reveals kind of the level of insincerity that you would take a stand in one case and not in the other.
Yeah. And especially, I mean, a regime, I mean, this is, I guess, you know, these are always questions of, do you engage authoritarian regimes or do you try to isolate them? Or do, you know, when they get to a certain size, you really, I mean, you can't isolate China from the world. And then is it a question of engaging it? And the mere act of seeing, you know, NBA players, I can see the argument that the mere act of basketball puts into the minds of viewers, whether they're in America or China, a certain kind of elemental, representation of freedom, of both individuality and teamwork, but of expression, that itself might be revolutionary, regardless of, you know, the larger context or the weirdness of the financial transactions between the NBA and an authoritarian regime that has, you know, millions of people in political camps and whatnot.
Yeah, I agree with that. But I think that these corporations, they would do well to draw a line at some point and just realizing that China, their entire MO is they will allow a certain level of, you know, content in, but it's going to be highly controlled. And ultimately, if you don't kind of bend the knee, then they are going to kick you out. And so I think that maybe there needs to be more thought out, like, corporate strategies of, you know, how far are we actually willing to go? And it gets even more complicated when you talk about tech and their, you know, desire to get these tools into China, but only China's only allowing it to happen under their specific conditions where they have complete control over it. So it's a conundrum.
Right. And including their exports, right? Where, you know, certain Chinese technology coming out of Chinese firms or Chinese sources are, you know, the United States as well as Europe is kind of, we're not sure if we want to do this because they might have back doors in place. And, you know, we don't know, is that just protectionism under a certain name or is that a well-founded concern that China is actually using its kind of industrial might to, you know, put in tendrils and surveillance, you know, apparatus all over the globe?
Well, I'll say this from a consumer perspective, nobody in Hong Kong uses Chinese technology. So think about that when you're making your purchases.
So just as a final thought, do you have any sense of the end game or a timeline here going forward? You know, these demonstrations have been going on for months. Is there a sense that this has to end by, you know, year's end, or that there's some culmination, or is this something that might just continue, you know, on and on and on?
That is the big question, and was the question I kept asking there. And that was one of the fears that I encountered, is that this might just kind of like drag on in a very like middle of the road type of way and nothing really gets done. But I'd say since I've left, things have seemed to continue to escalate. And I am fearful that this is going to culminate in some sort of violent confrontation. The way that could be avoided is, as I mentioned earlier, There are five demands that the protesters are making. The most important one is increased democracy. They want to be able to choose who represents them. And they feel like that alone is going to give them the ability to kind of protect this liberal system that they've had since coming from the British common law. And there was a former British governor who famously described Hong Kong as a peculiar situation where they have liberty without democracy, because they have these essential liberties enshrined in their basic law, but now they need the democracy in order to protect those because they kind of just feel like the system has been hacked by Beijing. And they, everyone I talked to for these pieces said, like, this is our last stand. If we don't get this now, we don't think it's ever going to happen. And it's more or less the end of one country, two systems as we know it.
Wow. Well, we will leave it there. I have been talking to Zach Weismiller. He is a recent TV producer who is just back from Hong Kong. You can see the series of live from the streets video documentaries about the Hong Kong protests at Reason.com, at our YouTube page as well, Reason TV. I have been Nick Gillespie. I'm your host. Please subscribe to us at Spotify, at SoundCloud, at Google, at Apple, at Reason.com, or wherever you get your podcasts. Zach, thanks so much for talking.
Thank you, Nick.
And thank you all for listening. Again, please subscribe to The Reason Interview. Thanks very much.